Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Josh Silver. He's a consultant and senior fellow at the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. He spent decades involved in efforts to protect and strengthen the Community Reinvestment Act, along with fair lending laws and data disclosure laws to hold financial institutions accountable for their lending practices. Josh was also a development manager at Mana Inc., a local nonprofit housing developer based in Washington, D.C. He also served as a research associate at the Urban Institute in D.C. Josh Silver's new book is titled Ending Redlining Through a Community-Centered Reform of the Community Reinvestment Act. It's a meticulously well-researched and documented account of the practice of redlining in America, which undermined access to capital and home ownership for Black Americans and other populations of color for generations throughout the 20th century. Josh offers potential solutions through reform of the Community Reinvestment Act. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange, Josh.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, I'd like to start with the introduction in your book. It lays out the premise of the problem that you're addressing. So would you mind reading a part of your book's introduction on page 5?
Certainly can. Where you live often determines your life chances, and lending discrimination places residents of community of color at significant disadvantages. Recent research by Raj Chetty and his colleagues reveal that all else equal, low-income boys who grow up in such areas with lower income, earn about 35% less on average than otherwise similar low-income children who grow up in the best areas for mobility. For girls, the gap is closer to 25%. The research found that neighborhoods with large populations of lower-income and African-American residents in some of the largest cities, such as Chicago, Atlanta, and Milwaukee, in our country have some of the worst odds. The Fair Lending and Civil Rights Organization, where I worked for almost 30 years, the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, has produced similar research detailed in Chapter 1, revealing stark disparities in health outcomes, as well as economic outcomes, depending on a person's neighborhood. Tragically, these outcomes did not happen by chance. They are a product of systemic discrimination. Racism drove the development of housing segregation and separation of the races, immigrants, and religious minorities into distinct neighborhoods. White neighborhoods had the advantages of superior schools, healthcare, and job opportunities, while people of color were cornered into neighborhoods lacking these opportunities. Initially, jurisdictions such as Louisville and Baltimore passed laws that prohibited African Americans from purchasing homes in desirable neighborhoods. After the Supreme Court struck down these laws, real estate and other powerful economic brokers developed racial covenants that prohibited whites from selling to African Americans, Jews, and other immigrant populations deemed to present destabilizing influences on neighborhoods. Chicago real estate interests were among the pioneers of racial covenants, but they were not the only pioneers. Baltimore's mayor also embarked on a similar path in the early 20th century, declared Blacks should be quarantined in isolated slums in order to reduce the incidence of civil disobedience, to prevent the spread of communicable disease into nearby white neighborhoods, and to protect property values among the white majority.
That's quite a start to your book. How would you describe the problem of redlining?
Well, as you can tell, that it was purposeful and systematic and widespread. And this was early in the 20th century. And then around the 1930s, of all things, the Franklin Roosevelt administration collaborated with real estate professionals, bankers, appraisers, to develop these maps. You can think of them as redline maps, where they color-coded neighborhoods. And neighborhoods that were color-coded red were the least desirable and most risky to lend in. They didn't get any loans. And neighborhoods that were color-coded green were white and affluent neighborhoods and were the most desirable neighborhoods to lend in. So you can imagine this formalized the practice of redlining, where banks and other lending institutions over the next three decades largely avoided the redline neighborhoods, whereas the neighborhoods in green got plenty of loans and thrived. And you can imagine redlining combined with other forms of discrimination really resulted in severe disadvantages, lower life expectancy, of the type that I read in the introduction.
Well, you also write, quote, "Whites entered the middle class, while discrimination shut the doors to opportunity for too many African Americans during the 20th century," end quote. So let's identify some of these culprits here. Specifically, which kinds of institutions and organizations of power perpetuated such racial discrimination?
Well, from about the 1930s to the 1960s, banks made very few loans to African Americans. Back then, the Federal Housing Administration guaranteed loans. So if a loan went into foreclosure, the federal government basically assumed a loss. And this was a much larger part of the market than it is today. And a startling statistic that I found when researching for the book is just 1% of FHA loans went to African Americans during those three decades. And African Americans were a much greater percentage of the population. So home ownership in those decades, and especially after World War II, was a primary means for white Americans to enter the middle class and to get the American dream of home ownership and accumulate wealth and provide for their families. And these opportunities were systematically denied African Americans. So in a lot of inner city neighborhoods, without home ownership and without lending markets and other forms of discrimination, you had some rather dramatic increases in poverty, much lower life expectancy. So my book looks at the Community Reinvestment Act, a law passed by Congress to try to end this practice and to try to get lending into formerly redlined neighborhoods.
My guest is Josh Silver. He's the author of Ending Redlining Through a Community-Centered Reform of the Community Reinvestment Act. So, Josh, it sounds like there's this co-conspiratorial cohort of government, banks, and other financial institutions. And in the second half of our conversation, we'll focus on the range of possible solutions. But for now, I want to zero in on the problem that has persisted for eight generations after the Civil War. So let's go back to the Homestead Act of 1862, when more than 200 million acres of lands were distributed by the federal government to white Americans over the course of 70 years, well into the 20th century. Meanwhile, the Freedmen's Bureau, which was established in 1865 by white radicals in Congress, promised only 40 acres and a mule to newly freed black people who weren't even regarded as American citizens. Now, the political war that the Freedmen's Bureau triggered at the time of its signing, Abraham Lincoln was assassinated just weeks after signing it, seems to be the genesis for the problems that we're still dealing with today. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I can see that you're a student of American history. I really enjoy American history and the struggle against these forces of evil. Really admirable people, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, Abraham Lincoln. And you're right, the problem really goes back to slavery. And the incredible racism that was used to justify slavery, that African Americans are inferior. And if you think about that quote from the Baltimore mayor, he had the same attitude generations later. African Americans needed to be quarantined. And, you know, the Reconstruction was a glimmer of hope. There was admirable radical Republicans in Congress, Abraham Lincoln, and then after Abraham Lincoln, Ulysses Grant. Well, Andrew Johnson, no.
Andrew Johnson actually was the antithesis. Here's the thing. Behind these racially motivated, systemically racist programs resides this ideology of racial hierarchy, the valuing and devaluing of humans by this mythological construct of race and white supremacy, as you noted, and it still exists today. And in 1860, the year that Abraham Lincoln was elected president, there was a popular book by Sidney George Fisher that laid out a mainstream belief in white supremacy. I want to quote from it very quickly. The book was titled The Laws of Race as Connected with Slavery. And here's what Fisher wrote, quote, "To understand slavery, we must understand the nature of the white man and the Negro. Of these races, the white is the highest in scale and the black the lowest. The white alone possesses the intellectual and moral energy which creates that development of free government, industry, science, literature, and the arts which we call civilization. The black can neither originate, maintain, nor comprehend civilization. He is by nature a barbarian. When in contact with the white race, he naturally and willingly yields to it and becomes its servant. The two races have exhibited these characteristics in all ages. The white race must of necessity, by reason of its superiority, govern the Negro wherever the two live together, end quote. Now, this mindset seems to underscore the problem that your book is dealing with today. What are your thoughts?
That's exactly right. This is a ideology that gets embedded in people's subconsciousness. And you're right to trace this back to slavery and to a short-lived promise of Reconstruction to rectify this and to empower the African-American population. But then it was stomped down by racism. And quickly, the South developed Jim Crow that kept African-Americans in segregated communities and kept them out of the schools. And then you have the Great Migration of African-Americans to the North, seeking a better life. But the North was not immune from racism either. They established redlining, you know, again, that Baltimore mayor. So this goes from the 19th century through the 20th century. And then you fast forward in the 60s and 70s, there were some white ethnic advocates in Chicago where you had these predatory real estate agents that would go into white ethnic neighborhoods and said, you have to sell your house now because the African-Americans are coming. So what would happen is the white ethnics would sell their house at bargain prices, and then the predatory real estate agent would jack up the prices and sell it to the African-Americans. Now, Gail Sincotta was a white working class in a white working class neighborhood in Chicago. And she and her colleagues thought, if we can just get banks to stop redlining and to offer responsible loans, and maybe we can stabilize the neighborhood and make it integrated by race. And that's the genesis of the Community Reinvestment Act, to fight the hatred and to fight the fear and to require the private sector institutions to make safe and sound loans in neighborhoods in danger of segregating.
It's interesting, that point, require. Here we are, eight generations after the Civil War, still dealing with the exact same issues that aren't past PAST, but rather past PASSED, down to each generation. Do you believe it's possible to reform an act of a white Congress without addressing the mindset that's motivating a recalcitrant resistance to such reform?
Well, that's a deep philosophical question. I believe, like Martin Luther King, that one solution to this hatred and racism is contact, is integration. And in fact, when whites have contact with people of color who don't look like them, and it's realized that these are ordinary people that want to provide for their families and are good people, hatred tends to go down. So you do have to sometimes start with a law, and then with a law saying, there has to be some decency here and some efforts of integration. And then hopefully the morality catches up and the ideology catches up and people's views of others who look a little different catch up. And in that context, that's one thing that the CRA was trying to do, is saying to banks, you have to serve the credit needs in all communities. And you can't just stereotype a person, an African-American, who walks through your door. You have to treat that person fairly and see if they, on objective criteria, whether they qualify for a loan.
Well, it's interesting because telling people who are predisposed to racial segregation, to tell them that they cannot do that, that's what the Supreme Court said in 1954 with Brown v. Board, to desegregate the schools. And yet, in 1958, the Alabama Pupil Placement Act nullified Brown v. Board, as Dr. King eloquently spoke about and wrote about in his book, Why We Can't Wait, in 1964. And here we are today. Desegregation in the schools is as bad as it was in the 1960s. Is it possible? And I know we have about 30 seconds before we have to take a break, but is it possible for the banks to change their systemically racist policies?
I think so, because one thing that CRA does is it requires banks to affirmatively assess credit needs and to go out and to talk to a loan officer, talks to a person of color and just realizes that person of color wants to work hard and play by the rules and buy a house and start a small business and want to pay the loans on time. So you get enough experiences like this, and I think attitudes of bank employees change. And there's a whole CRA infrastructure, if you will, with thousands of banks and nonprofit organizations working together. And I think that has changed people's views over time. We still have a ways to go, but a law like this is a really important start.
We were talking before the break about the problem that's, generations old. But now let's talk about the solution, or what could be part of the solution. Let's talk about the Community Reinvestment Act. It was introduced as a solutions-oriented reform of racialized segregationist policies and practices of the 20th century regarding home ownership. Is that right?
Yes. And I can briefly describe it to you, how the nuts and bolts, how it works.
Tell me.
So the law says banks have an affirmative obligation to meet credit needs of all communities, including low and moderate income communities, consistent with safety and soundness. The way that this lofty legal command is implemented is there are three federal agencies, including the Federal Reserve Board, that conducts CRA exams of banks. And think of a CRA exam as a report card. And a bank gets a rating or a grade based on how many loans, investments, and services they offer in low and moderate income communities. And imagine if you're a student and your report card is publicly available on the internet. That's the theory of public accountability. If my report card was on the internet, I would work harder in math and Spanish. So banks are encouraged to work harder in making creditworthy loans to creditworthy people in low and moderate income communities. And that spur of public accountability has literally resulted in billions of dollars of home loans and small business loans and other types of community development financing that probably otherwise wouldn't have been made over the decades.
Well, that sounds really, really promising. There's a challenge to that that I want you to address. And there are two. The first is that the government, since the Great Recession, has fined the banks more than $243 billion, according to a MarketWatch report, for ongoing systemic racism in their banking policies. And then in 2020, you had Citibank come out with a report saying that the nation had lost $16 trillion in unrealized GDP, principally because of the ongoing systemic racism in banking policies. And then it updated that report just last year in 2024 and said that $16 trillion, now it's $21 trillion that we've lost in GDP. So we have the CRA ongoing, and yet it seems like the trend in banking and access to capital is worsening.
Well, the answer is a little complicated, but I will tell you that for decades, CRA was increasing home lending to low and moderate income communities. In 1990, the CRA ratings actually became public. They were not public before. So from 1990, for about 5 or 6 years, there was a tremendous increase in safe and sound and conventional lending to low and moderate income people. And then, you know, in the years before the financial crisis, there was this risky subprime lending. And some commentators blame CRA. CRA is forcing banks to make unsafe and unsound loans. Actually, it couldn't be further from the truth. The law requires banks to make safe and sound loans. And the unsafe and risky and abusive lending was done by independent mortgage companies that were not covered by CRA. So then you have the financial crash. And then after the crash, positive CRA things happen. There is increasing home and small business lending. But perhaps now it has plateaued. It is stagnating. And one reason is CRA needs to be updated with the times. You can think of the federal bank regulations as designing the CRA exam. What's going to be graded? What type of activities? What geographical areas? Well, the last time a major reform of the regulations was 1995. And guess what? 1995 was really before the internet. So 30 years later, we had a regulatory update in the Biden administration to take into account internet lending, for example, that was beyond the bank branches. Well, elections have consequences. And the incoming Trump administration has announced and is proceeding with a repeal of the Biden regulatory update to CRA exams, or better CRA exams to take into account developments over the last 30 years in the banking industry. So because the Biden regulations were never implemented and now they're going to be repealed, there's a certain relaxation, if you will, in the bank industry. So some of that stagnation that you talk about, some of that is attributable. If you don't make the exams tougher to take into account changes over time, there will be stagnation.
Well, it seems like the Trump administration is the Andrew Johnson administration of our time. You call for community-centered reform of the CRA. What does community-centered reform look like?
Well, that's an excellent question, and thanks for asking it. Make it easier for community stakeholders to participate in the CRA process. Residents of neighborhoods, nonprofit organizations that serve the neighborhoods, like housing counselors or small business technical assistance providers. First of all, make it easier to find out when a CRA exam is occurring. It's actually not easy. It's kind of buried in the bank websites. Make the publicly available data that anybody can use on home lending, whether it's a CRA examiner or a member of the public, it's not necessarily easy to get that data right now. And when banks want to merge, they are required to submit an application to a federal bank regulator. And over the years, and they're required to demonstrate a public benefit of the merger. And over the years, they have negotiated what is known as community benefit agreements with community-based organizations. We will commit to more loans and investments in low and moderate income communities after the merger. And to give you one statistic, since 2016, NCRC, where I worked, and its member organizations negotiated 22 community benefit agreements with 22 banks worth $588 billion. And that represents more lending and investing that would not have happened absent the merger application process. Well, if the merger application process is not community-centered, you won't have as many of these public benefits and community benefit agreements. To give you a quick example of this, the Federal Reserve Board used to have a footnote in its merger approval decisions. Community benefit agreements are not required by the CRA regulation. That's what it would say. And that's technically true. But wouldn't it be more community-centered and more inviting to participation if that footnote said community benefit agreements are one very important way to realize the legal mandate of public benefits? And also to have more public hearings when these mergers are occurring. They're very complicated transactions with a lot of differential impacts depending where you live in the country. And some administrations are more friendly to hearings and community-centered forms than others. And you can imagine the Biden administration was more friendly to this than the Trump administration. So that's what I mean by community-centered. Make it easier for communities who were the victims of redlining to participate, because they have the best insights about how banks can best meet their credit needs. And you get this healthy increase in safe and sound lending if CRA is community-centered.
My guest is Josh Silver. He's the author of Ending Redlining Through a Community-Centered Reform of the Community Reinvestment Act. Josh, you quoted a friend of mine in your book. You write, quote, "Bob Dickerson, an African-American civic leader in Birmingham, remarked that the accountability ought to be on the community's condition, status, and look. I could take you on a ride through Birmingham, and you tell me if there could be a bank with an outstanding CRA rating. It doesn't add up," end quote. Well, Josh, I kind of agree with Bob, and I want to know, what is the barometer of success and the indicators of progress being measured if a Black leader in a historic civil rights city plainly states what it ought to be?
Well, Bob is one of my heroes as well, and I was pleased to have been able to interview him, and I've gone down to Birmingham and worked with Bob, and he's right. There are too many neighborhoods that look absolutely devastated. On the other hand, there is bank finance affordable housing occurring in Birmingham right now, and a lot of that is due to CRA. Remember, bank discrimination was a very powerful force against communities of color, but there was a lot of other forms of discrimination, whether it comes from job discrimination, inferior schools, you go down the list. So CRA can't solve everything, but I can tell you that there are neighborhoods in Washington, D.C. I do a case study in my book, a woman named Sabrina Walls, it is a homeowner in Anacostia that was a redline neighborhood, and now it's a neighborhood that's coming back. And because CRA requires banks to lend in all communities. On the other hand, there's a redline neighborhood in Baltimore where a young man named Freddie Gray grew up and had lead poisoning because of peeling paint from his house. And he was cognitively impaired, and he encountered police on a hot summer night on a street corner in 2015, and you can guess what happened. And that is a poignant victim of redlining. He didn't have the tools to deal with when the cops came. So it's a tale of two cities. You have devastated communities, and CRA needs to get stronger and combined with other efforts to serve those communities, but you also have success stories. So, you know, build on successes. Hopefully, when the climate is more favorable for CRA, we can go back and get some of the Biden regulatory updates and update the law possibly as well.
Well, the Federal Reserve data from last year shows that the entire housing inventory in America is 146 million housing units. And of that total, white Americans own 75% of all the houses. And the clamoring to build more houses to address the affordability crisis means that white Americans will own 75% of the additional houses built, unless there's a different strategy and approach to housing policy, which the banks are deeply entrenched in. What do you think?
Well, one thing I discussed in the book is CRA does not look explicitly at lending by race. And African Americans were one of the original victims of redlining. And I discussed this history. It's not easy in this country to repair the wounds and the discrimination inflicted all the centuries against African Americans and other people of color. But I do talk about different approaches to this, and we're going to keep advocating for that. And, you know, one other thing about housing, there is a huge problem with zoning in this country, that single family homes on large lots. Well, that locks out a lot of low and moderate income people, whites as well as African Americans, in jurisdictions across the country. And there are efforts of zoning reform. Some succeed, some fail. But this has to be done in conjunction with CRA reform, because trying to do one thing won't solve it. You got to have a multifaceted approach. You got to strengthen CRA. You got to have zoning reform. You got to make the schools better. You got to go after employment discrimination. And it's not going to be easy. It's easy to get frustrated. But I think there's a lot of strong advocates that will keep going.
What do you hope readers will take away from your book?
Well, this type of law is very important, but it's also very important to empower the people, that you just can't have a solution from the government or the corporations top down, that you also need to have the people involved in revitalizing their community. And to, you know, hopefully people will read it and understand not only how Congress makes laws, but then there's a regulation and the federal agencies implement the laws. And that's a process a lot of people don't understand. But hopefully people have a better understanding of these processes and also advocate for laws that really also empower communities in rebuilding themselves.
Well, I really appreciate your efforts to find solutions to the generational problem of redlining and systemic racism in the financial industry. Do you think that the solutions that you offer with a community-centered reform of the Community Reinvestment Act will be seriously considered and implemented by those in positions of power, wealth, and influence?
Well, that's a multi-billion-dollar question. And I think that we're going to have to do a great job educating and persuading. And that's one thing I hope to do with my book. And also building a groundswell for democratic reformers, small d. There was a great civil rights movement, and we need to revitalize that in some form in the future years. And hopefully, if there is another great social movement, it can take things like CRA and other reforms and promote it.
Well, unfortunately, there seems to be a social movement. It seems to be run by the Trump administration, and it's going the other way.
Well, you know, in history, you have progressive movements, and you have movements that are not so progressive. You know, the KKK was a grassroots movement. But then again, you had the civil rights movement, the labor union movement. So hopefully, you know, Martin Luther King and preaching hope and love, hopefully that type of empathetic institution building. That's what I'm enamored of, and that's what I hope one thing that people will get out of the book.
Empathetic institution building. I like that. And you sound like an empathetic societal change agent.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate you writing the book and coming on the Jefferson Exchange. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thanks so much, Josh.
Thank you.